What keeps you going? Where do you get your motivation? Whether you just want to be the best you can be or the best there ever was, we're here to keep you inspired. Conversations with today's top fitness influencers, coaches, athletes, and bodybuilding professionals. This is Inspired Fitness. Here's your host, Sean Feuderer.
Welcome back to another episode of the Inspired Fitness Podcast. I'm joined today by my co-host, IFBB Pro, Kimberly Helm, along with our very special guest, Carrie Williams. Carrie, thanks for joining us.
Yes, thank you for having me.
You own a number of businesses, including a brand called Tussle, which, as I understand it, is all around equipment for women in combat sports. You're involved in a number of different things. Would you tell us a little bit about what you've got going on?
So yeah, currently Tussle, it is a women's fight gear company. We are the only female fight gear company owned by a woman in the United States. So that's pretty cool. The brand is really all about women's combat sports, starting with boxing, because that's my specialty. So we have started with boxing gloves, hybrid boxing gloves, headgears, mitts, wraps, you know, all of the gear that's needed for the ladies boxing. But we're starting to get interest from other combat sports. So MMA, kickboxing, even jiu-jitsu. People are asking if we have gis and all sorts of things. So that's the direction we're going. We want to be a full-blown female combat sport brand and where all the ladies go to get their gear. It's not just a shrink it and pink it brand. The equipment is actually form-fitted for women's hands. So we have gone through different molding to make sure that they have proper fitted gloves, mitts, and so on. It's something that hasn't really been done in the space. Most of the larger combat sports companies, they're geared toward men. It is a male-dominated sport. You know, combat sports in general are. So we're trying to change that and give the ladies something that it fits properly and it looks good. We always love looking great. We can fight, but it doesn't mean that we can't look good at the same time. So that's what Tussle is all about. So I've been in the boxing space for about 26 years, opened my first boxing gym about that long ago, and it was called Primetime Boxing and Fitness. And at that time, I knew nothing about boxing, fitness, or business. So my story is very backwards. I went into the business of boxing and fitness. I became a coach for boxing, so for the athlete and the non-athlete. And then I became a fighter. So very backwards. And the reason that I did compete in the sport is because I really wanted to know the sport in and out, especially if I was training competitive fighters. So if I'm up on the ring apron is what we call it, but if I'm up there in their corner and I'm telling them something, I need to know what I'm talking about. I need to know what the strategies are. I need to know what they're feeling. You know, there's so much that goes into boxing aside from the physical. It's really mostly mental. So I needed to really be aware of what was going on in their minds and how to deal with that. So that's why I started competing. And it just made me a better coach. It made me a better person. You know, it did a lot for me. I got to experience something that few people get to experience. And I'm very happy that I did that. Yeah, it hurts when you get hit, but you know, you learn how to not get hit.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, kind of in a nutshell how Tussle all came about. There's a lot of space in between those two things, my first boxing gym and Tussle, but just to kind of give you an idea of, you know, how far back it all started.
You know, Kim and I both have a bit of experience in combat sports. She's a jiu-jitsu practitioner. I grew up with kickboxing and other martial arts and competed in taekwondo and other things. I've done a little bit of jiu-jitsu myself. You actually achieved some degree of fame as a fighter, right? In the amateur ranks.
I wouldn't say fame. I probably gained more fame as a coach than as a fighter. You know, again, you know, the fighting part of it for me was just to become a better coach. So while I was competing and I was growing my gym, I actually ended up opening a chain of three gyms and franchising the concept all while I was coaching and competing. But I worked my way up the coaching ranks with USA Boxing and became an Olympic level 4 boxing coach, which took, you know, a lot of work, a lot of time, a lot of experience. So I'd say probably more known for my coaching than my fighting.
nothing wrong with that. I mean, that's still, I understand what it took to get there. Kind of explain for folks what it means to be level four as an Olympic level coach.
Well, they have recently kind of changed how they, what they call the levels. When I were going through the rankings, it was 1 through 4. Level one is pretty much, you know, every USA boxing coach, to be a coach with organization, they have to be a level one coach to be able to be in the corner with their fighters and so on. And then level two is just kind of improving on your coaching skills. Level three, again, improving on your coaching skills. You have more experience under your belt with your fighters as a coach, and you're now getting into like national, international competitions. And then level four is where you're actually eligible to coach at the Olympics. As a woman in the sport, and especially as long ago as this, you know, all transpired, there really weren't any women at that level of coaching. So, you know, I would get the letter to apply. I'd always apply. But, you know, I didn't quite get the shot at coaching at the Olympics. But, you know, that's okay. I did have a female fighter that we went to the Olympic trials together. Just her and I traveled the country. And this was the first year that women were able to compete in the Olympics, which was 2012. So in 2011, we were going to all the trial, all the qualifiers. And it was such an amazing experience. Just her and I traveling around. She'd be up in the ring and I'd be down on the apron. And, you know, all the guys, all the coaches would come and say, "Hey, do you guys need any help?" And she would get so offended. But, you know, it was very cute. She would just be like, "No, we got this."
Yeah. What an amazing experience that must have been.
Oh,
that sounds so fun.
It was a blast.
Yeah.
And, you know, it always amazes me that only that long ago women were allowed to box in the Olympics.
Yeah.
It's pretty crazy.
You put yourself through the experience of being a fighter to understand how to be a better coach. That taught you obviously a number of things around what it means to train and prepare. Tell me a little bit about what you put your fighters through in terms of training and preparation.
You know, mindset was the first thing that was always really important, you know, from whether it was phone calls or, you know, the wake up at 4 a.m. and doing road work, you know, while my fighter's doing road work, we're doing sprint work, you know, I'm giving her, you know, different, it's not even like analogies of things, but it's like, how are we relating this with life? And what are we doing this for? And where's your mindset at? You know, when we get in that ring, this is what we're going to do. Always think about your hand being raised at the end of, you know, the fight. So it was constantly putting these seeds into her mind during training. And, you know, again, the phone conversations, it was all really, most importantly, putting her in that frame of mind of, we're going to go in there, we're going to do our best, and we're going to win. You can win or lose a fight before you step into the ring, just with what you're thinking. And I know a lot of sports are the same way, except just in boxing, you get hit. You know, that was really the most important thing. And then, of course, the training part, the nutrition part, you know, we're doing road work early in the morning, we're getting all of that done, we're getting our weight training in, we're getting our boxing training in. So, you know, it's really like when you're competing at that level, let's say for Olympic trials, you're really training about 3 times a day. They don't have to be really long sessions. You know, we don't want to overtrain as well, but you know, there's this kind of sweet spot that you have to hit in training.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what do you think, Kim? I mean, you know, we've talked to other folks who've competed at the Olympic level and kind of the same theme, right? Know your why, practice visualization, right? I'm kind of hearing the same thing here.
And discipline, and you mentioned that too, right, Carrie? It's you know, being dedicated, being disciplined, mindset, you know, all these things that Sean's referencing as well. I mean, there's a consistent theme when you get to a certain level of athlete. There's a certain minimum amount of character traits and qualities that I think is turning out to be very obvious that you have to have in order to get to that level and sustain it for over any duration of time, right? And I think, you know, I have so much respect for any athlete who gets to that level, because the demand, it is a full-time focus. It is absolutely a lifestyle at that point. And I'm curious if you want to go into a little bit more detail about it for us, to tell us a little bit about, like you said, you're going to get hit in the face. You have to be prepared to go through pain and suffering. It's a very hard sport, you know, as in not like hard as in difficult, but it's a very hard sport. And there's a lot that you have to go through. And as a female, I find, you know, if it's jujitsu or if it's Muay Thai or any sport that you go through that requires you have to take on a more competitive focused face, and you almost have to step away and put your feminine side away for a second, you know, while you're doing this. And it can be very much of a conflict internally when you're trying to turn it off after training is over and then be a normal person and know when to turn it on to go, you know, to get that fight life back. Right. So can you tell us a little bit more about what you've experienced with that? Is that something that you've seen as well, that's true with your athletes or with yourself? And how do you help to coach that side?
Yes. Great question. It is so, so true. You know, you have to put your fight face on. You know, they say game face, but it's like right. Your fight face.
Yep.
And you are just completely like chin down, eyes forward, pushing forward. There's nothing around you that is getting in your way. You're not thinking about anything but that task at hand. And you have to have that kind of masculine side to you to have this kind of spirit, this fight spirit. And it's great. I love having a masculine side. I love having a feminine side. I feel fortunate that I get to do both of those things and I get to feel both of those things. You know, it's very powerful. And if you own into that power, like you just really feel it, it's amazing. I do know that if you get kind of caught in that and you stay in that side, you don't get to be yourself as a woman. And so finding that balance is really, really important. And I'll give you an example. The gal that we went to, her name's Marina, by the way, but we went to the trials and we would go to the weigh-in and she would dress a certain way, almost like a boy. And I would ask her, you know, why are you dressing this way to go to the weigh-ins? And she said, well, no one's going to take me seriously if I dress like a girl.
Right.
And I was like, bullshit. I was like, go in there, do your hair, put your makeup on, get ready. We're going to the weigh-in. You know, you can show them what you got when you're in that boxing ring. That's it. You turn it on. But it doesn't mean that you have to keep that outside of the ring. You know, you need to be yourself and you need to feel comfortable in your skin. So yeah, it's this kind of balance that we have to figure out as women and in more male dominated sports and even not in male dominated sports. You know, it could be any sport. You know, you have to put that game face on, the fight face, and go 100% all in and just kind of, you just got to like feel it. Like it's got to feel like gritty and strong and, you know, and feel all of those feelings that you feel when you're competing. So yeah, it's a beautiful thing though.
It is. It's amazing. It is. But it's a difficult thing to establish. And it's hard to figure out who you are at that point. It's hard to balance, you know, especially, and I like how you're referring to it. And you do have to embrace a masculine side and you do have to embrace a feminine side and whatever is true to who you are, right? Whoever you are as your person, you have to figure out how much is enough so you can have both of those sides if that's what you want, you know, for yourself. So I think I like the way you explained it. It's neat to kind of see how different people approach it. And we've talked to a lot of different athletes, you know, male and female, right, Sean? And I always find it interesting for, you know, it's not to say that men don't have to deal with their own areas of exploration. You know, I mean, men have some things that are different that they have to figure out as well. I can obviously relate to a female who's trying to figure that out as you're engaging in the sport. And, you know, because in bodybuilding, which is something I've been doing for my whole life, you know, I would train mostly with men, and especially 10, 15 years ago, it was mostly men, and on leg day, and they're like, let's go. You know, you walk out the gym and, you know, you become part of this, you know, you become part of this rhetoric that happens, you know, you got to get sucked in, and then you get out to the car and, you know, you're just like, okay, you know, like I'm a woosaw, you know, to try to get back to what normal is, and that, hey, you know, now you can lower your volume of your voice and now you can, you know, you can soften up a little bit and that's okay. And, you know, so, but I understand that. And I get when you're trying to make an impression that I can relate. And I understand what she was doing when she was saying, you know, hey, I'm going to dress like the guys. I'm going to fit in. I want to earn that respect. I get that. I totally understand that.
Yep. That was exactly what it was. And I love that. Like, yeah, you get out of the gym or out of training and you just have this like, this like energy.
Yes.
And you're like, okay, we're back to real life here.
Yep. Sean, do you know anything about that?
I know nothing about how to get myself motivated for a tough workout. Nothing at all.
You do too. And I'm sure that you deal with this in a different way because you get energized for the gym and you train hard, and then and you have a family and you have kids and you have to turn on probably different aspects, I would imagine, as a family man and somebody who goes after the sport of weightlifting.
Yeah. You know, there is an element of turn it on, turn it off. The thing that I will never understand in any of this is, for female athletes, the effect on a woman's body from a hormonal perspective. We've gotten into this with every woman athlete who's been on the podcast. And Carrie, we'll ask you, you know, the same. How are you coaching people through dealing with that?
The thing is, with boxing, obviously hormones depend on age too, you know, so there's another factor to all of that. So it depends on, you know, how old are those female athletes? You know, what are they going through hormonally? Is it just their cycle? You know, are we dealing with just that, or are they getting older and we need to deal with replacement? You know, those are really important things. And, you know, it kind of goes across the board. I think that what is happening now is we're starting to look more at hormone levels and where they need to be at, and not for necessarily optimal performance, but just being, you know, in kind of a good range of hormone levels. And then, yeah, maybe optimal performance. But, you know, as we get older as women, you know, HRT is, you know, we don't talk about it enough. I mean, I'll be really transparent. You know, it doesn't really get talked about that much, replacing your estrogen, your progesterone, or even testosterone as we get older as women. It's almost taboo. You go to the doctor and, you know, they're like, oh, you're a woman. Testosterone is only for libido. No, it's not. It's for a lot of other things as well. You know, oh, you've got hot flashes. Well, just work through that. You know, it's just a part of getting older. You know, they're very dismissive. Let's just say that. So I think for coaches, I think it's really important that we are very aware of what our athletes are going through. You know, and again, what age are they, and, you know, what kind of cycles are they going through? So, yeah, I'm a true believer in HRT, and I just do think that it's a little taboo to talk about, which is very unfortunate because it's really vital in our health.
We are starting to see people such as yourself step forward a lot more comfortably and open that dialogue and discuss what those things are. And we're starting to see a little bit more movement, I think, in that general direction. You know, people are being a little bit more public about what they're going through and what it feels like. And, you know, there's so many sports out there, the sports that are drug tested, or, you know, I can use bodybuilding for an example, because that's my experience. You know, we have all natural competitions. But the challenge is that we haven't figured out how to differentiate between a prescribed level of hormone therapy and something that isn't prescribed. And so if you are in hormone therapy, you don't get to go into an all-natural competition because it's not considered all-natural, even though it's not, you know, it's not a banned substance. It's something that's prescribed for you, you know. So there's a lot of confusion still around how to do this and how to do it well and honestly at the sport level.
Yeah, completely agree. You know, I'm currently not training in any athletes where I would be dealing with their hormone levels or having to deal with, like you said, something that's banned, and you go into competition and they're like, sorry, you can't fight because of this, that, and the other thing. So right now I haven't had that experience in dealing with any athletes, as far as I dealt with it myself, as far as HRT and, you know, my own personal experiences with it and how important it is to have the right levels. It's something that I think we do need to talk a little bit more about. And even for men, I mean, I'll be honest, you know, if someone talks about, he's on testosterone. Well, okay, that's great. You know, he's replacing what is being lost. You know, it's healthy. You know, there is a healthy way to do these things, to have longevity or just have a very healthy life. Yeah, I think it definitely needs to be talked about more.
Yeah, I think, you know, 50 years ago, our food sources were very different. And, you know, the quality of our food was very different. And if you look at where we are today and the amount of things like hormone therapy, or whether it's men or women, both of us, we all need testosterone a certain amount, you know, whatever is going into our bodies, whether it's, you know, whether it's the plastic that we have in the world or the food quality, and we can get down a rabbit hole in all of this, right? But we know that there are things that contribute to the deterioration of our health. And a lot of that has to do, and I know you mentioned nutrition as part of your programming, you know, a lot of that has to do with the quality of food and the regular intake of what that food looks like. And that has everything to do with your hormones. It has everything to do with, you know, how we balance it all together at the end of the day when you're stressing your body in training that might be 2 to 3 times a day.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's true about the food. Fortunately, we do have access to more organic food. You know, and I'm not saying everybody has access to this. It's just for the most part, we all do. And I think having organic food in our diet is really, really imperative. Now, I say this because I actually have ulcerative colitis. So I know a lot about food for healing. If I weren't ingesting organic food, I would go into a flare and I'd be in the hospital. You know, I'm not on medication because I have healed myself with food. You know, food is medicine or it's poison. And so, you know, I think every individual, you know, coaches obviously need to be looking more into this, but even as an athlete, you know, having your own information and being self-aware and doing that research, because not everybody's bodies are the same as well. You know, one person could have endometriosis, right? Which is inflammatory. Somebody could have UC, somebody could have all sorts of different ailments. Depending on what they're eating or not eating is going to make a big impact on their health, and their lifestyle is going to change according to that. You know, maybe I can't go out and have a drink. Maybe I have to eat organic and that's all I can eat. And I have to find a way to make that happen. So yeah, food is absolutely important.
You know, you said a couple of things earlier about optimal performance. When I think about what that consists of, attitude, you already started with the kind of the mental side of it. You've got the physical training side of it. You've got the nutrition side of it. And there's two other things that kind of sit after that in my view, right? And that's how you recover, right? In between, whether it's fights or training sessions or whatever, there's an amount of recovery. And then the final bit of the puzzle is sleep, right? Do you incorporate those things into your training programs?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I always feel like athletes do need a little bit more sleep than the average person. And, you know, a lot of times people are getting an average of like 6 to 7 hours of sleep. So that means that my athlete is going to have to get 8 or 9 hours of sleep. So yeah, I mean, sleep is absolutely important. But going back again to, you know, where their hormones at, well, if their hormones are imbalanced, then they may not have an easy time going to sleep, you know? So we're talking about sleep patterns. You know, their scheduling, you know, obviously some people, if they train later at night, they have a hard time falling asleep. Maybe they tend to do better if they go to bed early, they wake up very, very early and start their training. So you kind of have to figure out that individual and what their sleep patterns are and when do they get the best rest, and maybe cater the training program around that for them. You know, maybe they do well if they take an hour nap in the middle of the day or whatever it may be. But yeah, sleep is absolutely important. Recovery, absolutely. We all know that we have to deal with our recovery. A lot of people don't want to do recovery because it's, you know, it's a time consuming thing, you know, but we've got so much to do. I'm kind of that way. but it is so important. You know, everybody's recovery obviously is different too. You know, what if somebody just does really, really well with stretching, or they get their body work, or they do grafting, or they like the ice bath, or the sauna, the dry sauna. Again, everybody is very different and you have to figure out that athlete and what works best for them.
Yeah. I mean, so Kim, how does that relate to you to the bodybuilding space?
You know, very similar in regards to the fact that everything, it has to be specific for the person that you're dealing with. And I, you know, really and truly, while we might see a theme, you know, we might see that, hey, you know, with things like cold therapy, you know, whether it's from water therapy or air cold therapy or whatever the case may be, we see all kinds of studies come out with this. We actually talked a little bit about this with one of the other folks that we interviewed named Dr. Jenna. And we talked a little bit about how, you know, we often go to things like scientific studies to find out what types of recovery are good? What's working? Is an ice bath better before you work out or after you work out? Is it better for only for recovery if you're injured, or is it good for growing muscle? You know, what circumstances apply to all of these tools and resources that we have? There's a lot of data that's out there. There's a lot of conflicting information. And we also know that oftentimes a study can be biased because of the people who are funding those studies, you know, so it's very difficult to see through all of it and figure out what's mm-hmm. right. And at the end of the day, I think, you know, as a coach, we really have to sit back and not only try to experiment with some of those things ourselves to get a feel for what works and what doesn't, but also really do a great job of assessing the athlete that we're working with to figure out what works for that person. And while we want to rush into applying multiple things at one time, when we do that, we can't really tell which thing is working and which thing isn't. And that's the hardest part, is that it takes so much patience to change one thing, only one at a time, to figure out if it's an isolated incident or if it's really something that's contributing to a long-term solution.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so true, whether it's food with your diet or, yeah. you know, like you have to do an elimination diet. What food is, you know, making me feel good? What food's making me feel bad? If you're doing it all at the same time, you're never going to know which one's working and which one's not working. So it does take time. It takes patience. And I do agree. It's, you know, everybody is so individual. You know, you can do all the research and, you know, dig very, very deep and try those things out. But again, you know, the studies usually are funded by, you know, certain folks. So it's hard to get true data sometimes.
That it is. But trial and error seems to be the only means and mechanisms that truly work. You can understand the effect, you know, a control group or a placebo group from a study, but until you feel the effects yourself and understand how they're working for your body or your, you know, your circumstance, the rest of it's kind of irrelevant. It seems to be consistency, right, around the training. Consistency, being consistent in your approach, is going to get you 95% of the way there. That other 5% is someone or something giving you that extra edge, right? Mm-hmm. That's where you as a coach, I imagine, find that, you know, your athletes bring in the right attitude and they're putting in the effort. Your job is to figure out how to get that extra 5% out of them. Do you have any tips or tricks on how you go about that?
Oh, wow. Good question.
I like to call this unlocking that hidden potential.
Yeah. You know, I'm trying to think back with Marina, because, you know, I did spend a lot of time with her and we went through a lot together in the boxing world. But I would say that once everything is all said and done, and in this reference would be, and you're getting ready to step into the ring, is having a very brief conversation, you know, as to why are you here? Because I love it. You always want to hear that. Because I love it. Okay, what are we going to do? We're going to win. You know, it's so simple, but it's just those few little pieces right before competition that really pulls out everything that they have just spent so much time doing, so much energy, so much blood, sweat, and tears. So yeah, just a few little tidbits right before getting in the ring.
Yeah.
I have to imagine that as a coach who's, when you're with Marina, for example, and you're traveling all over the place for these Olympic trials, you have to get very close in your relationship. I mean, because you're spending all of your time together. I mean, it crosses the barrier of, you're not just coaching at that point. You know, there's a different level of relationship that has happened that you've transcended at that point. And I imagine that it's tearing on your heartstrings as well. I mean, from a coach, you want to see Marina do well, but then also as a personal friend, or as, you know, whatever level of relationship that goes to, it's something that you're invested in it, you know, so you're invested just as much as the athlete, I'm sure. So can you tell us a little bit about, do you have any dialogue with yourself as far as how far do you go with your coaching relationship? Is there a place where you get too personal, where it gets too close, and then it inhibits you from being a good coach? And what does that look like?
Yeah, there is a fine line. I always have told, and I've actually, because I've owned so many different gyms and I've had coaches that have worked for me and coached other athletes, one of the things that we've always talked about is that line not to cross. And that, in at least in my sport, is that you don't train with your athletes. Hmm. You train them, but you don't train with them. You know, so it's not really, it's like a pecking order. And I mean, maybe that's not the right term, but it's like, I'm the coach. You know, we may get on a personal level, but you will always remember that I am your coach. Right. I'm not your equal.
Right.
And yeah. I think that that really helps to keep that line between the two of you, but it also, it allows them to really still respect you. And also just for you to have that kind of, you know, a bit of control over what's going on, because as a coach, you have to have that level of control so that your athlete is doing the things that you're directing them to do. If you're training with your athlete, sometimes it gets too personal on that level. And then it's really hard to kind of reel that all back in. So I would, at least for me and in boxing, that's kind of how I've always dealt with it.
Fascinating. Because each person does it differently. So I always think it's really interesting what works for different people.
Yeah, because there are definitely coaches and probably in your sport as well that they might train with their athletes, but there's still a level of respect and they understand you know, where the line is at. You know, and maybe it's because boxing is a contact sport.
That's very possible. I'm sure. There's a lot more personal feelings that go into being getting punched in the face.
You know, I understand where Carrie's at with this, right? So when I was training for combat sports, whether it was whatever it was, I trained a lot for kickboxing way back, way, way back in the late 1980s and early 1990s. You know, I would spar with people who were instructing me. And there came a point in time when I could beat them. And, I was very young and I was very ignorant back then, but that had an effect on their ability to coach me going forward. It really did. And I could imagine in any combat sport, you know, that kind of holds true for at least some portion of the athletes.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you look at Tyson and D'Amato, like they didn't spar each other. I mean, you know, but if you look at like, you know, old traditional boxing fighters and coaches, you would never see, and it was usually older, kind of like always an older guy that was the coach, right? Even in Rocky, but you wouldn't see them training with their fighter. It's a little different.
I think the opposite kind of holds true in, well, I'll call it the fitness space. It's not just necessarily the bodybuilding space, but had plenty of coaches over the years. Kim's been one of them, although I don't think you and I have ever competed in our lifts. But you know, other coaches who you know I've trained with, it becomes a competition. And that was not, there was no deterioration of the coach client relationship there. It was more of a push, because I don't think there was so much pride involved. Like, you know, getting punched in the face, there's a little bit more effect on pride there.
And with any coaching, whenever you're, you know, whenever you have a coach, whether you're looking up to the coach as from a student perspective or whether you are the coach, you know, there's always a level of knowledge that has to transcend that relationship if you're going to have respect for that person. So, you know, whether it's form or speed or, you know, whatever the case may be, there has to be something that you are bringing to the table, obviously, that the athlete doesn't have without your knowledge.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. If you're on an equal playing field, there's no point of you being someone's coach. So yeah, you've got to come with a lot more experience. You need to have, you know, you're bringing something that they just don't have and you're giving that to them. But they always say, you know, like in boxing, at least we'll say when my fighter becomes a better fighter than I was, that's when I know I've been a great coach.
Yes. I love that.
So, you know, you're giving them everything and then they get to add what they have as well. And so you want to hope that your athletes always become better athletes than you were.
So yeah. Carrie, do you focus on a certain niche when you're coaching, when you're looking for athletes or when athletes come to you, are you looking for a specific age group or experience level? Is there a certain niche or you're catering to the whole gamut?
Well, since I've started Tussle, I haven't really been coaching as much. That's kind of been taking all of my time. But, you know, when I was coaching more, definitely there's kind of a window. I love training female athletes, but I've trained many, many male athletes. Age-wise, I've always really enjoyed starting with the teenage years. You know, a lot of people go, oh my God, the terrible teens, you know, but
I love it. I love the teens.
Oh, I just love working with teens. They're at this impressionable age where you can actually have some really great impact on them, not just for the sport, but for life. You can teach them a lot of things. They'll actually listen to you because you're their coach, whereas they won't listen to their parents. And also they're just at an age where everything is starting to work for them mechanically, and they're like little sponges. And so you can show them something and they almost have this kind of photographic memory of you showing them something, and then they can do it just like that. I just love that age bracket to work with and kind of mold, you know, into being great fighters and great humans.
Yeah, I don't know how often you get to work with teens other than mine. Are teens in your client list?
Yes. Yes, I'm very fortunate when I, especially, you know, for high schoolers, whether they're trying to prepare for a certain sport or they're just trying to be happy with who they are when they look in the mirror, really and truly, with today's social media, you know, reputation can be devastating, and how people treat you on social media can be devastating. So a lot of time can be spent, you know, most people who come to the gym, and we, you know, you and I have talked about this before, Sean, most of the time when people come to the gym, whether it's adult or teens or kids, it is because they are looking to feel something. It's more mental than it is physical most of the time. You know, most of the time the physical part is because of where they are mentally. I think teens are a blast to work with. I share very much your sentiment, Carrie, when it comes to they're impressionable, and most of them are very respectful, and they want to learn, and they pick it up fast. And, you know, if I work with a pro level athlete, a lot of times those folks are like, I've already been there. I know what I'm doing. You know, like they're gonna have some of them have a little bit more of an attitude, a little bit more edge about them. And it's not to say that they don't have, they're not fun to work with at a different level, but it's fun to have somebody who's a teenager who just wants to absorb everything versus somebody who's had a lot of experience in life. They're very specific on what they want to be exposed to. And that takes a little bit of a different type of approach. So that's where I think the differentiation comes in. And I love working with the youth. So yeah, I get to work with some teenagers, and I love doing it. And even some junior high kids, not that you're trying to stress their bones when it comes to weight training or anything like that, but the agility training is where that comes in, and it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, adults are hardwired already, and their bodies can be kind of hardwired too, mechanically, and how they move, you know, whereas teenagers, they're still very pliable. So there's a lot of big differences.
Yes. And when you're an adult, you want, you know, you have this ego that comes along with age and experience, you know, that you, and you want to do well. So then all of a sudden you're tense and you're stressed, and, you know, the kids are like, you know, this is fun. Let's just do it. You know, and it's just a different level of approach. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Completely agree with that.
I think Carrie may have seen me in the gym once or twice with my mechanical movement.
It's terrible. I have seen so much, you know, and boxing is also one of those things that people feel very silly doing. That's the challenge, right?
For people who are truly good at boxing, there's so much grace in and style in how you move. For me, it's, you know, it's fascinating.
I did want to ask, I'll pick your brain for a quick second, get your professional input on this one. So for the longest time, one of the things for me as an athlete, when I was trying to focus on the things that would help my training, whatever that might be, whether it was training for an Ironman or bodybuilding, or I do all kinds of sports. Sean laughs, you know, because I'll jump in anything if I have an opportunity to try it. I used to spend a lot more time focusing on recovery, because sitting in the ice bath for 3 minutes only took 3 minutes of my time. And, you know, doing something like stretching takes a little bit more effort and time. And now I'm finding, you know, so much more time that is dedicated to things like stretching before and after a workout. And that, especially in the aging process, and as you get more experience and as you have more life behind you, that doing that, incorporating something, whether it's yoga or Pilates or just a really good stretch technique, it really benefits the programming in exponential manners. Is that something that you've seen a lot, or is there something specifically that's a go-to for you or for your athletes?
Yeah, you know what you just said. I mean, the two main ones are stretching and adding in yoga, which is, you know, kind of a form of stretching. But, you know, when you have guidance, I think it just makes it a lot simpler for people, instead of, you know, taking, you know, you're like, okay, before I do this, I've got to go do my stretching. And then when I'm done, I've got to do my stretching. You know, I mean, as athletes, we're dedicated to what we're doing, so that's fine. But if you have guidance and you can do a yoga class, you know, that's great. Because then I don't really have to think about it. I'm just go, you know, that's all we do is we think, you know, we're training or we're coaching or whatever. It's like constantly we've got to think about everything that we're doing. Yoga, you go in there and you watch them. Okay, this is what I got to do. Boop, boop, boop. And then you do it. So I'm a big fan. I don't like the cold plunge. I know everybody's like loving it, but I can't do it.
Everybody who is in the bodybuilding space that I've spoken with, is anti-ice bath. In their view, it doesn't promote muscle growth. But everybody who is a performance-based athlete, whether that's a runner or, you know, even combat sports or baseball or what have you, is a big fan of the ice bath. And I don't know where I sit on it. I don't do it, but I'm also not a performance athlete.
I do like sauna, dry sauna too. I think that's great for recovery. And there's a lot of other health benefits to a dry sauna as well.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, I wish I had access to a sauna. I would use it. I would, but I don't. So stretching is kind of the default.
Yeah, I have a lot of injuries from head to toe. So yeah, I've been doing lots of stretching and sauna.
Almost like you're in combat sports.
Yeah, that old neck.
Oh.
So are you trying to stay more with the tussle side of business now versus coaching? Is that the preference?
Yes. You know, 26 years of coaching, it's kind of a long time. So, you know, I love working with women and girls. I feel like right now is a really good time for tussle because we don't really have anything out there for women. And I love just, even though I'm not coaching anymore, I love to kind of go to the different gyms and hang out with the girls and they're sparring and then we shoot the shit and, you know, I get to watch them and give them some tips here and there. And then they wear the gear and, you know, it's just a thing. I really enjoy tussle community. You know, it's like we're building this whole like female fight community. So I really, really get a kick out of it. You know, coaching is really rewarding, obviously. But for boxing, you know, my father told me, you've done enough charity work for a lifetime, girl. So, you know, it's kind of time that I can take, you know, all of my experience and everything, still do what I love doing, still help our female athletes, but also, you know, be able to make some money. I mean, at the end of the day, when you're an entrepreneur, that you have to kind of do that. So I figured that it all comes, you know, full circle and it's amazing.
You're still coaching, but it's just in a different way now. You know, you still get to coach by the products that you put out, and then you can give some guidance on how to use those products. I mean, I think it sounds like I can hear the passion in your voice when you talk about it. And I think that's awesome. So stick with it. Go for it. I'll definitely help to spread the word as much as I can.
We don't normally get into politically charged questions here, but I happen to see your Charlie Kirk interviews.
Yeah.
And so Kim, Carrie's been on some nationally publicized interviews around transgender athletes, men competing as women in women's sports. Mm-hmm. And, you know, frankly, I think this is an incredibly difficult subject to talk about. And I've listened to your interviews and I tend to take your point of view on it. Like, I think some of these biological men can actually do some real damage to a biological woman in a combat sport.
Oh, yes, they can. You know, I've sparred with teenage boys that have bruised my ribs, you know, and that they're not even trying to hurt me. So yeah. I think it's hard for somebody on the outside to understand the true danger of a biological man boxing women. And, you know, aside from the dangers of it, it's completely unfair and it's encroaching on our space. You know, like I said, we just were able to compete in the Olympics in 2012. We had to fight to get that. And we only had 3 weight classes. It took time, you know, and as I've said before, everybody can be who they want to be. If you're a transgender athlete and you want to compete, then you have to work just as hard and just as long as women had to get their space in those sports. That's just how it goes. That's life. You know, you don't just go, I want to do this and boom, I get to do it because it's all about politics. Yeah. So yeah, I have a pretty strong view about it.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's interesting is it's now starting to bleed into bodybuilding as well. There are now categories for, it's not just transgender, but it's identity, alternative identity type of categories where you got biological men competing as women in wellness categories, for example. Kim, I think you've probably seen some of this in the more recent competitions.
I've seen it. There's actually one particular, and you might have, it might even be what's generating part of your question, Sean. There's actually one particular picture that has been floating around social media over the last week or two. It was a different federation. It wasn't within the federation that I participate in, but it was one of those where it brought up all kinds of questions from all federations, and everybody was freaking out because they just didn't know how to handle it, you know. And a lot of, and I want to say, like, from a jiu-jitsu perspective, if I believe what I was reading for jiu-jitsu competitions is that whatever biological parts you are born with is the category that you will compete in. Right. You know, and then it's, you know, obviously there's, you know, according to weight and all that kind of thing. But I think that that's kind of how they're sticking with, you know, framing the rules to be able to cater to everybody as best as they can and still treating everybody as fairly as possible. And I do know that there are some athletes out there who are caught in the middle on trying to figure out who they are. And, you know, that, and they just, it's difficult for both sides. It really is. It's not easy for either side of the fence. And there's a lot of heated discussions about it. And I think that really people have to really get somewhere with it. People have to step back from the emotions on it and really work through what the options are from a factual perspective and still treating everybody with fairness. And that's not always easy to do.
Yeah, I agree. I think emotions out of it, I think across the board in life is going to be very, very helpful. And, you know, really looking at what the reality of it is and, you know, the science of it is, do the research. It's pretty much in every sport. I don't know that it hasn't touched any sport yet. Some of them haven't been talked about yet. I know that in my sport particularly, you know, with the IOC, actually, the IOC for every sport, they have given each governing body the ability to make the rules.
Right, right.
But they encourage inclusivity, which that term is gotten just...
Yes, yep.
Anyway, so they're kind of passing the buck, right?
Right.
So you guys all figure out what you guys want to do, which is kind of crazy because all of those governing bodies, all those athletes are going to the Olympics.
Right.
So the Olympic committee is going to have to kind of sit down and go, okay, this is what it's going to be.
Right.
And I do believe that a lot of the governing bodies, the reason that they are allowing this or making rules for it is because they don't want to get sued. And, you know, in swimming, there is an individual that now is suing. I think it's called World Aquatics. I can't remember the name of the organization, but they're suing because they're not able to compete. So I think that that's why they're all doing this. It's all about concern of being sued. With boxing, because it is very dangerous, they should probably think about being sued for a death or a serious injury, rather than being concerned about being sued for not allowing somebody to compete.
Yeah, discrimination.
Yeah, so.
Valid point.
It's a pretty heated subject nowadays.
Safety needs to be the top priority.
It does. And it's difficult because you know what? This isn't the black and white. This is the gray, right? So it's not a cut and dry. There's exceptions to every rule. There are men that I know who are very petite, who, you know, who may, their frame may be much, much smaller. And I might be able to have more muscle than they have when it comes down to who has more muscle for a bodybuilding competition, you know, and I'm talking about, you know, certain cases, right? But
small percentage.
Small percentage, because we know that for a fact that, you know, when it comes down to looking at a male versus female from, you know, genetics that they were born with, that there is a muscle difference. There absolutely is. This is the scientific
skeletal act. Everything.
Absolutely. Skeletal structure, muscle structure, how they hold their muscle, how women hold fat. Like, there is a difference in the genders. And I think, you know, while there might be exceptions to those rules, it's not the norm, you know, so it's really hard. It's hard to cater to everybody's needs and still be fair. So it's a difficult thing, but I think the sooner that, to your point, every organization can choose their own rules, but at some point when they get to the elite, they're all going to be in the same place.
Yeah. I'm not sure why that's going on. And again, it's just kind of passing the buck. I don't know.
Because I don't think everybody's afraid to say what the answer is. You know, everybody's afraid of, you know, offending certain people. And there's just no way. Yeah. And there's just no way that you're going to please everybody. That's just not going to happen.
No. And I think you said it right, is that people are very concerned about offending people. And, you know, I'm just not of that. I don't come from that cloth. I think that, like, what, if, if this is reality and we have common sense, this is what it is. And if it offends somebody, I'm sorry, but you know, it's just, it's the reality of the situation. So, but yeah, it's fun times.
Well, good. We're going to end on a very politically charged note today.
Brilliant.
So, but Carrie, listen, thank you so much for being here. This has been a great conversation. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much.
Well, folks, join us again next time for the Inspired Fitness Podcast. Until then, we wish you a healthy mind, a healthy body, and healthy habits. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to Inspired Fitness, leading you to a healthy mind, healthy body, and healthy habits. To stay inspired, visit us at inspiredfitness.net. That's INSPIRD.net. Until next time, stay inspired.